Hello, everybody, and welcome to Middle Age Geeks, where we aim to chat about movies, TVs, games, tech, and anything geeky that takes our fancy. Very happy February to everybody, and for this whole month, we will be revisiting some of the greatest movies to celebrate 25 years of some absolute bangers that came out in 1999, so we're going to party like it's 1999. And we'll be covering some games also from 1999 in our retro corner. So, my name is Daz, and I'm one of your hosts, and my other co-host is Phil. How are you doing, Philly?
Doing pretty good, man. Yeah, it's been a fine week since our last episode. Yeah, it was a lot of it was a lot of fun doing a really good movie.
That's great. Week. Yeah,
you know it really was, because it was good to talk through and share our love for cinema rather than God, wasn't that shit? What?
Yeah, we had a bad run there for a while.
Happy days. Yeah, all right, yourself?
Yeah, pretty good. Juggling kind of babies and a lot of time, which is always tricky. But yeah, I managed to watch our movie this week and play the retro game and play a few other games that we'll get into a little bit. But just for context for our episode this week, and for this month, and why 1999 is widely, I guess, regarded as one of the, if not the greatest years in cinema in recent memory, or maybe ever. Here is a little list of some of 1999's movies in no particular order. We have The Matrix, Fight Club, Sixth Sense, Galaxy Quest, Magnolia, Three Kings, The Iron Giant, American Pie, American Beauty, Green Mile, Boys Don't Cry, Princess Fucking Mononoke, Being John Malkovich, Thomas Crown Affair, Any Given Sunday, Sleepy Hollow, The Insider, Eyes Wide Shut, Ghost, Straight Story, Bringing Out the Dead, Election, Office Space, Human Traffic, Toy Story 2, Blair Witch Project, Girl Interrupted, and Summer of Sam. And that's... Wow. There's a lot more than that as well. That's a shortened list.
You left off one of my favorite bad movies that I've seen 100 times.
Yeah.
Deep Blue Sea came out that year.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I saw that in the list. Sharks, they swim backwards, man.
Oh, fucking, I love that movie. It's so
still
bad.
Got one of the best death scenes ever.
Oh, yeah.
Surprise death scene. Yeah. Remember that? Got a fucking jump, all right. But yeah, truly an astonishing year. And Phil this week is going to be taking us through the absolute classic, The Green Mile, directed by Frank Darabont and starring Tom Hanks and Michael Clarke Duncan. And following that, I will be looking back at Worms Armageddon on the N64 from 1999. But, before all that, what have you been up to, Philly? Been playing anything or watching anything?
Yeah. Well, I last week I was saying I was playing The Last of Us Part 2, so I made sure I went ahead and finished that. It's funny, like, I love that game. I've played it through a few times. You know, there were tears. even though I've played it a bunch of times, I love it. But it's gas. Like, I kind of decided to look up online to see if there was any news on a third game, because of the fact that the show did so well, I figured that we're going to be hearing news on a third game. And I just stumbled across some Reddit threads about people talking about this game, Last of Us Part 2.
Yeah.
And like, there's so much hatred for it. Like, I knew people weren't massive fans, but like the slating, the writing and everything, like, they hate Neil Druckmann. They were saying, like, calling him Neil Cookman, which is just the laziest fucking thing. But, but like, they're just so much hating what they did to the character of Ellie. But in a weird way, like, I don't want to go into it, but like, some of the comments around what they did, you know, what they did to Ellie and what they made her into were just a bit weird. It's like, hang on, she's a child in the first game. Don't be getting all creepy with it. I know, look, Reddit's a creepy place, but still, even reading through it was just so much bizarre. Now, luckily, those people are, like, they're saying that the franchise is poison now and it needs new writers and new directors. But I mean, the thing is that, like, Naughty Dog aren't going to care about that, because it was massively successful, both critically and sales wise, you know, so there's no chance of that changing, that they're changing writers and director and all the rest of it.
Yeah. But you'd have to think that a lot of the time when you see, you know, sensationalist posts, you know, like IGN or something online, where people go, there's an outrage regarding such and such a thing. And it's an outrage because seven people said something on Twitter. You know, and it's just like,
from the whole, like, there was murder in this
sales, like, you know, it's a small pocket. Yeah,
there was murder about this when it first came out. We don't need to go back through the whole lot of it, but it wasn't that they changed, your main character. It was that there was a trans character and a gay character. And it, you know, that was the issue that was fucking bothering people. Like, just fucking grow up. But anyway, apart from that, apart from that, I went to see The Holdovers.
Oh yeah, nice.
Which, yeah, oh my God, it's fucking fantastic. It's just this, it's a wonderful movie, and it's Alexander Payne, you did Sideways and Nebraska, so it's got this really lovely folky soundtrack to it, and Paul Giamatti is incredible. It's got that feel-good factor as well as being, you know, bittersweet in certain parts, and it's just, I love the whole aesthetic. It was just really enjoyable. I love, there was one great line in it when he's shouting at somebody, and he says, like, for most people, life is like a chicken shack ladder, short and full of shit.
Nice.
Yeah, that. And then the only other thing I watched was Society of the Snow. J.A. Bayona directed. You know, it's about the Uruguayan rugby team that crashed in the 70s in the Andes.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Remember that? You know, the movie Alive. Alive was about that. You know, the same thing. Yeah, no, I loved it. Like, Alive was a good movie, but cut out large chunks of it, you know, whereas, like, especially the trek, when they finally made the trek and try and find civilization, that was like 10 days long, and like Alive just did it in a, you know, almost like a montage kind of thing. made it look like they were just strolling down the village, like, you know. So yes, this was much more, no, they didn't go into the, still didn't go into as graphic, because I've read a good bit about this thing in the past, so I know exactly what they had to go through. So they held back, but at the same time, you know, there's bodies there, rib cages exposed because they have been fucking picked dry. You know, it was, they didn't hold back from a lot of stuff. Like, it's what those people went through. But I think, I think Jay Bayona can be a bit hit or miss, but when he does Bleak, he does it really well.
It does really, really good.
The Impossible and stuff, he does that really well. Yeah. Michael, is it Giacchino? I can never pronounce his name right. Is it Giacchino? Yeah, really, because I was listening, I was like, God, the soundtrack has a bit of a Lost kind of vibe to it. And then turns out it was him, and he also did Lost. So, but yeah, no, that's all I've kind of been onto for the last while. What about yourself?
Well, I had to, following on from that list of games, new games that I've been playing and haven't been able to finish anything, I added another game to the roster. I got stuck into Pal World.
No way, really? Yeah. Okay.
Well, I say stuck into it. Well, for anyone that doesn't know what we were chatting about last week, Pal World is this survival game that's taken the world by storm. It's released in early access, so it's still kind of a work in progress, kind of a beta. But it, and these figures are astonishing. Like, it's sold 8 million copies in less than a week. Like, 8 million fucking copies.
Insane.
Like, it took Spider-Man 2, I think, 11 days to make half of that, which is
but money wise though, you know, I don't think in terms of growth, 70 quid, like,
but it's still incredible. But yeah, it's billed as, you know, Pokemon with guns, and it's not, it's really not. Like, it's a 3D survival game, you know, obviously, where you play as a human in a world inhabited by pals, these kind of creatures that you can capture and used to help you survive the world and blah, blah, blah. And you have to gather resources and build bases and weapons and stuff. And I'm not a big survival guy at all. But, you know, I said, right, I'll just spend an evening and give it a go. And it really goes into, it kind of touches on the darkness that, if you think about, like, Pokemon and capturing these creatures in little balls making and stuff fight, like that, making them fight with you. It's very, quite dark. Like, I captured one creature, this little kind of goat thing, and it would act like a shield. You know, if I press the left bumper, it would come up as a shield. But when I draw it out to use it as a shield, you could hear it kind of screaming slightly. It was just like, holy fuck. It's just like, it's a bit kind of strange. But I lasted about 2 hours. There was a few kind of, not so much bugs, but it, from the offset, it would not reset. Well, it wouldn't, I wasn't able to change the, I always invert the Y-axis and X-axis in settings. Yeah. And just whatever I did, it said, you have to respawn to get these settings to change. And I kept respawning and started the game again, but it just wouldn't change it, which is pretty fucking annoying when you're just running around and the camera keeps swinging all over the shop. So that was pretty annoying. But then, yeah, I was going along and enjoying it to a point, but then I went off and decided to go on a little trek, you know, down to a beach and try and see what I could find. Yeah. And then the sun set and I froze to death on the beach. And I was just like, oh, fuck this shit. No clothes on or everything. It's yeah, it's not really for me, but I yeah, you can see why people are just dying for an open world Pokemon game like this. But this is not Pokemon with guns. It's more kind of a survival, cutthroat survival game with Pokemon-y creatures in it. But yeah, I won't be. I don't think I'd be going back to it.
Would that be enough games to be enough games to be keeping you going?
But what I've been watching. We spoke about this in our year wrap up. Top Boy finally finished the fifth season, which is only six episodes long, and yeah, just really good, excellent series. We talked about it before. It's just fantastic. The acting, writing, cinematography, score—you know, it's everything's fantastic. But there was one thing, like it reminded me. And this seems like a strange thing, but it reminded me of the last scene of the last season of Game of Thrones in terms of it just felt a bit different in terms of. I think it was obviously the pacing. It went from maybe 10 episodes, 8 episodes, down to 6 episodes. So there was one kind of, I'm not going to give anything away, but like there's a character arc that they need a few more episodes to sell it. It kind of happens over the course of an episode and a half. And while potentially believable, it just, you know, myself and Ali were just looking at each other going, that's feels a bit rushed, a bit forced. And then something happens and then, the whole kind of season is about somebody just trying to undo something rather than kind of progressing the story forward. It's just felt a little bit slightly short, and I'd heard people were had some reservations on it. It's still a phenomenal show, and it ended with a bang, really. But yeah, it just felt a little bit off, and I was curious. I went straight into just check, was it different writers or different showrunner? Did something change? Why?
Yeah.
Why make the change from even 9 episodes to 6 when Netflix were just throwing money at them anyway? So it just felt weird to rush something like that. Yeah. But yeah, but anyway, yeah.
I still will watch it. Like it's, as I said, I'd watched the original, but never got into watching that. So I will get around to watching it for sure.
Yeah. It's a top quality show, but yeah. With that out of the way, let's move on to our movie review. So over to you, Philly.
Great stuff. Thanks, Daz. Yeah. So as Daz said, like these next 4 weeks are a party like it's 1999. There's so many incredible movies. It was really tough to pick one. And definitely, even this one, I had second thoughts because the movie's over 3 hours long. I was like, shit.
Hmm.
We're gonna condense this fucker into that.
So, like 3 hours.
Yeah. So like, I mean, we won't go into massive into detail. Kind of do the highlights and our favorite parts, and you know, and talk about the movie that way. But I just felt it had to be done. It's such an amazing movie, and I sometimes feel like it's underrated because, especially say in Ireland, because it just seemed to be shown constantly on television. Like it's always fucking seen to be on RTE or whatever else. It was just rerun to the point where everybody. Ram down their throats, but that shouldn't take away from what is an absolutely incredibly well acted and directed movie. So let's just jump into it, and hopefully it'll bring back some memories for those of you who haven't watched it in a while. So the basic synopsis is that it's set in the 30s in America during the Depression, and Tom Hanks plays this like a lead guard on death row when this large black inmate is brought in, played by the late great Michael Clark Duncan, and it turns out he has like mysterious supernatural healing abilities. And it's based on this short story by Stephen King, like a serial short story that he was releasing like every week, because apparently people kept skipping to the end of all of his stories, you know? So we started releasing them then weekly kind of thing. So people were sort of mini cliffhanger in each episode kind of, you know?
That's great.
With him, he didn't even know how he was going to finish it. And Stephen King still doesn't know how to finish his book, to be fair.
Yeah.
But, so Frank Darabont directed, as Dad said, and this is the second time that we had a Frank Darabont Stephen King prison movie, Shawshank Redemption being the other one. 5 years as previous was that 94?
Yeah, 94. Yeah.
Another cracking movie. This one surprisingly didn't win any Oscars.
Yeah.
Green Mile. When you think about it, that just shows you the year that this was. What came out this year just shows you, you know, the caliber of movies that were out there. And when you look at the performances and everything in this. So we start off the very early setup is just to kind of let you know what happens. And it's like this, like a split between two parts. The first part has been this, people are out hunting, looking for these, search party, looking for someone that's missing. And then it cuts into modern day and it's Tom Hanks's, an older version of Tom Hanks's character. And he's telling it, he's having a rough time in the retirement home and he confides in a friend what happened that way back then during this movie in the mid 30s. And so it just then, that's when it kind of cuts back then and we get into our main story. And we're introduced to the cast fairly quick on. And for me, I think that some of these people have career bests in this movie. Like David Morse, incredible.
Never been better.
Barry Pepper. Like I don't think I've ever seen him bad in a movie, to be honest.
Yeah.
But he's just fucking class in it. Your man, Jeffrey DeMunn as well. Like I think that these, for me, the movies I've seen them in, these have been some career bests. Like they were fantastic. But yeah, so as I mentioned at the intro, like John Coffey, this big, huge guy gets brought into the prison and he's massive, but he's kind of, and they're all a bit worried about what he's going to do, but he's kind of a bit slow, a bit simple. And they used a lot of really good camera tricks to make him seem bigger than he is. Like James Cromwell is taller than Michael Clark Duncan, you know, but the way they shoot it. Yeah.
That's like, for the force perspective. Yeah.
I think David Morse is the same size as him. Tom Hanks is only 6 inches shorter than him. You know, they had them like trenches either side where he was walking, or sometimes they'd have him up higher, always just to make him fucking massive, you know. But straight away they made like his bed really small, and the electric chair that he sits in, they made that smaller, you know, everything to make him look huge, you know. So we kind of find out then he's brought into prison. What's his face is reading the sheet, Tom Hanks, and finds out he's brought back in because he's brought into prison because he was found covered in the body of the bodies of two girls under his arms, and they're covered in blood. So that's just the start of it. And he's brought in. So I'd love to just check when you first watched this, Daz, do you remember what your feelings were towards this character? Because obviously as the movie goes on, we start to love him and realize that, you know, what had happened. But at the start and the whole start of this movie, what was the setup like for you when you watched it again?
Yeah, it's the kind of imposing nature, exactly as you're saying, the camera trickery when he just walks in. It really, like myself and yourself are front row seaters in a cinema. So I'm watching this and he's even more ginormous when you're looking up at a fucking 30-foot screen. It's just just kind of terrifying, but it's almost like I kind of had an idea. Not where the movie's going or anything, but you're just kind of going, okay, this guy, it's almost like you want to unravel the mystery of what is going to happen here when he's kind of introduced. But it's the fact that they take so much time. We talked about this in a few episodes of movies and it's a pain for some people when a movie's 3 hours long. When I see it's 3 hours long, once it's at least 4 stars, I can't wait to see how they let it breathe. And they spend so much time setting up the characters in this. Like you're saying, they all give career best, but they all, you know, and we'd obviously get into it, but like the first hour of it is just setting up all these guys. It's just takes its time. When John Coffey arrives, it's just like, holy fucking Christ. And all I can remember, all I could think at the time is just like, I didn't think he was that fucking tall. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not even thinking about what they're doing. Like, there's just a shot where he's just standing around the camera. The camera's a little bit lower down, but not so low to be a ridiculously forced perspective, like cheat shot. But you're never thinking about, he's standing on a chair or something like that, because they're walking and moving with him. And as you're saying, little things where they just dug those little trenches beside. It's just a simple thing like that, where just a shot with him walking in with people beside him who you know are around 6 foot. They're not like Tom Cruise size actors. It's just that, it's the visual imposing character that, really, really, it's such a visual, like, oomph. I thought it's just fantastic. And you're just waiting to see how it's going to play out.
Exactly, yeah, because it's because it's a, you know, it's it, because it's like this, it's a prison movie, and you're getting this guy from the very start, and you see him with two young girls covered in blood, and like, oh, how did they explain this away? And I'm sure the first, I don't remember, but I'm sure the first time I watched it, I was probably like, fuck, man, this guy did it. You know what I mean? Mm. He's covered in blood. He's holding two girls next to him, and he's screaming, saying he didn't mean to.
How,
he tried to take
how
it
are
back.
They going to, you know, how are they going to do this? How is this actually going to play out?
I suppose before then we get, like before that, or after that, shortly after that, we kind of get introduced or get to know two of our kind of actual kind of bad guys. Mm. The first one is Percy, played by Doug Hutchison. And if there was a list of movies for most hateable characters, you know, I'd say people must have spat them walking down the street. Like the character is fucking so dislikable. Like there's a little mouse that's running around inside the prison, and he's fucking tries to stamp on it. He attacks the prisoners. He whacks Delacroix in the hand. All the guards hate him. He's just this sadistic little worm of a human being.
Mm. When people it's just so good. Like he's so good that you fucking hate him. You know, he's just a gloriously despicable piece of shit. I think like Tom Hanks has a line where he says, the man is, he said he's mean, careless, and stupid or something, and said that's a bad combination in a fucking place like this, and you're just going he's a little fucking scrawny little weasel, but because as we find out later the power he kind of has, it's just terrifying. He's dangerous,
he knows people, but he's like you know, as you said, he's a this weasel, he's a fucking coward. Mm. And we kind of see his cowardice kind of shortly after when we get to meet a new prisoner is brought in. So at the time, so far, we've got this kind of, I can't remember the actor's name, but it's kind of a Native American type prisoner.
Oh yeah.
There's Michael Jeter's playing a kind of Cajun dude called Delacroix. And then we get brought in this Wild Bill character played by Sam Rockwell, who's just an absolute fucking lunatic. You know, they're called,
he chews the scenery, man.
But he chooses him, but he's incredible. Like, and he starts off, they kind of go in to transfer him. And when they go to pick him up from like the lunatic place he's in, he's standing there like catatonic. There's drool coming down his face. He's just completely out of it. Like, so they have to dress him and everything. And then he's just pretending like he's drunk. But he turned out when he gets to the prison, all of a sudden he gets a look on his face and he's been pretending. Yeah. And he grabs Barry Pepper's character around the neck, James. And he can just see they're trying to get it to go, and shouting at Percy, quick, go and hit him with your bat and hit him, do something. And Percy's too fucking terrified. He's got his back up against the wall. And luckily Brutal comes in. Brutal, played by David Morse, comes in, whacks him over the head. They carry him into his cell. But Sam Rockwell is fucking hilarious. Like, he's just this
so good. He's just so good.
Psychopathic, everything he's in. Lunatic. Yeah. But yeah. But he nails this. It's just this absolute fucking scumbag. but like we've the start, we've learned that Tom Hanks has been suffering with this UTI, this worst UTI that anybody's ever had. Basically, he describes it as pissing razor blades. And just fucking saying that, you fucking bend over like, ugh. But this is kind of the first time we see John Coffey, Michael Clark Duncan's character, use his kind of powers properly. Mm. So he calls over and he calls Tom Hanks over, and Tom Hanks is in bits holding his fucking crotch because he got a whack in the nuts off Sam Rockwell during the fight. So of course, with his UTI and everything, he's in just agony on the ground, but he shuffles over and he's like a bit closer. And when he gets to the cell, John Coffey pulls him over, puts his hand on his fucking crotch and basically absorbs all the badness out of him. And then he opens his mouth and all these fucking flies, like,
that's such a creepy visual, right?
Come out.
Yeah.
Yeah. They all come flying out of his gob. And that's basically him releasing all that horrible stuff he took in. It takes a lot out of him. And, but he said, he goes, what did you just do to me? And he goes, I took it back. And then you kind of get that first clue as, oh shit, maybe he didn't fucking kill those kids. Cause that's what he was saying. I tried to take it back and I couldn't, you know? So Hanks then, of course, has gone out and doesn't realize. He's like, what have you done to me? And he goes out, realizes he's actually able to take a piss for the first time in don't know how long. And the look on his face is just like, I'm sure I've made that face myself after holding in like 6 pints of piss. Just like, Jax. It's just look of relief. So he goes back and he's able to have sex with his wife. There was a great line the next day when he comes in and he brings back in cornbread for John Coffey as a gift from his wife. And he goes, "What's that for?" And he goes, "Oh, it's from the wife, you know, for helping me." And he goes, "Oh, was your missus pleased?" And Max goes, "Several times."
yeah, fucking brilliant.
It's really, really good. I think, the next part then is we get on to, again, is more and more of the stuff is ramping up with Sam Rockwell and in his character. And we get, again, to see more and more sides of Percy, like how much of a sadist he is. Like he wants to be in control, that he wants to see the people dying. He wants to be upfront for people getting the electric chair. But we see in a couple of scenes, just how nuts Sam Rockwell is and how fucking and how much shitty Percy is that he, Jeffrey Munn is cleaning and next he turns around and he's been pissed on through the cage by Sam Rockwell. And so they come in as if they're going to put him in a straitjacket check and they fucking hose him down with a power hose, fucking fire hose, and they throw him in the padded cell. And then, so eventually anyway, he gets out after, like, they throw him in, he gets out and he grabs Percy because he gets back into his own cell. He grabs Percy and eventually lets him go, but he grabs him and Percy ends up pissing himself. And you just see that because he's just terrified of everything that happened to him. And Delacroix laughs at him. And Delacroix at this point has taken the mouse that's in the place. He's taken him over as a pet. The guy he calls Mr. Jingles.
Yeah.
And Mr. Jingles goes running across the floor and Percy fucking stamps on him out of spite. And again, it's just more and more just digging in.
Yeah, it's just
showing these characters. Yeah, but what an asshole he is. Now, John, again, uses his powers and brings the mouse back to life and all the guards are able to see it this time. Like, holy shit, because the first time it was only Dell and Tom Hanks that saw him use his powers. So they're like, wow, he really is a miracle. What did you kind of think at this part? Because before we get into the next part, which is what Percy does to Delacroix as kind of his revenge. How are you feeling at this point of the character building and everything? Because, I mean, we're probably only hitting halfway to the movie at this point.
That's the key thing. We're kind of halfway there and you're almost thinking, like, not where is it going, but it's just like, how long is left in this movie? Where are these characters going, or how worse is Percy going to get? But it's that it's on repeated viewings when Delacroix laughs and Percy kind of catches him laughing. You're just like, ah, you just know something.
Yeah, like he's singing a song like Percy pisses pants, something. Yeah, like he's singing a song at him, and
yeah, that's know, pretty
just yeah.
But but it was the mouse being stood on. I remember in the cinema and just a collective groan from hundreds of people. It's just such a, you see grotesque things in movies all the time and people doing despicable things. But it was just that moment of pure, just like, he's just going, fuck you. That's the one little piece of happiness you have in this shit show of a place. And I'm going to fucking stamp it straight away, knowing that this guy is only short time left before he goes to the electric chair. And you just take that one last little bit. It's just, you know, and he gets what's coming to him.
He gets what's coming to him exactly.
But at that point, you're just going, I really hope they do that, you know, because movies with this, you know, we talked about happy endings and in Poor Things last week. But in a movie like this, you get a sense that there may be some element of a happy ending, but it's going to be pretty dastardly or pretty shitty for certain characters, and you're just hoping that he's the one that just doesn't get to ride off into the sunset after doing this kind of shit, you know. But
and that's it. Like, that's kind of the point where you think, can he do anything worse? And they kind of say, they've said to him at this point, look, we'll let you be up front for an execution as long as you promise, you know, that you're fucking gone after this. You'll take that promotion that was offered yesterday. We don't want to see it. Don't want to see you again. And just when you think the stamping on the mouse and doing all this stuff is the worst thing you could do, the next part is just absolutely horrific. So
it's one of the most horrific scenes I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So Delacroix goes in, and it's not for the faint of heart. He goes in to get put in an electric chair, and you know, he has any of his last words, and he's just like, you don't know actually what he did. You don't know if he's a murderer or what, but you know, saying, you know, I'm sorry for what I did. I'm sorry for what I've done. But earlier on, when Percy is in looking at how the thing is going, he's explained to him that you use a sponge, it goes in the water, that goes on the head, and that conducts the electricity. So the death is like that, goes straight into the head. And that's what kills him. You know, always make sure that's dry. So obviously that's, you know, sending a bit of foreshadowing. Because when it comes to this execution, firstly, very cruelly, what he does is, just before Delacroix had gone in, he's worrying what's going to happen to Mr. Jingles, the circus mouse. And Tom Hanks and David Morris have said, well, you know, there's actually this place we can take him called Mouseville. Yeah. It's like a little mouse circus, and he'll be able to go there. And da, da, da. And so it's this nice memory that, you know, there's no reason to antagonize this guy. He's paid his debt. He's going to die. So they give him this nice thing, and he's happy that the mouse is going to be looked after. And just before, not only does Percy tell him while he's crying before he's dead, there's no such thing as Mouseville. These dickheads have been lying to you. He also doesn't wet the sponge. He just bends down, goes near it, puts the dry sponge on the head, and then he goes roll on to, and they shoot the electricity through him. And of course, it's a dry sponge, and it's not being properly conducted straight into the head. So he is bucking while there's smoke coming off the body.
Fries,
he bursts into flames.
Fries alive.
He's like, frying. Yeah. Fries alive, and they're like, you can't do anything. The smell is in the room. The people in the crowd who sick fucks who come to watch this kind of thing are all like, what the fuck? But he, you know, David Morris grabs Tom Hanks and goes, you can't switch it off. You can't stop it because, you know, we can't stop in the middle of what he's half fucking burning dead. You have to finish the job.
Yeah.
And so Percy tries to duck away, and Tom Hanks grabs him and turns him around and goes, you look at what you did. And he's just bucking and he's screaming, and the mask that's on his face, the fucking flames are coming through his, something out of an act proper horror movie. It's really, really traumatic. Like,
and the sound design in that sequence is no dramatic music or anything of the sort. It's just him frying, and the sound of the electricity, just kind of just the sound of him being charred alive. It's a horrible scene to listen to, let alone watch. It's one where in the cinema you could look away if you wanted, and if you did, you'd still hear it. And it's that kind of like, fuck off. Like,
it stays with you. Like, you know, I've watched it a ton of times, watching it again.
It's a tough watch.
This week. Tough watch. So anyway, he's brought down into the fucking thing, and, you know, Tom Hanks and fucking thing want to absolutely kill him. Like, look what you fucking did. He's paid his debt. Don't fucking touch him. Because even, you know, he's just a sick fuck. And we've seen James Cromwell a few times at this point, and this is kind of, we see him again at this scene as well. And we've met his wife too, Patricia Clarkson. We're told she has a brain tumor, but we don't actually see her just yet in a really bad way. She's just tired and da da da. But then James Cromwell tells him, no, look, she's really sick. You know, she's getting really bad. They did the scan, did the x-ray, and it's a tumor. And so Tom Hanks sits down with his wife, and he has the idea. He's like, what if we broke John Coffey out of prison, got him to Cromwell's house, and maybe he might be able to heal him. So they come up with a real fucking elaborate plan of what they're going to do. So they drug Sam Rockwell to knock him out. They get Pat Percy and tell him this is payback time, and they stick him in the padded fucking, what's it called, straitjacket. Throw him into the padded room. And it's here, we only find out later, there's a part here where John Coffey realizes it was Sam Rockwell that's the reason that he's in prison. And he's walking past, Sam Rockwell grabs his arm, and John Coffey gets a flash of all the bad shit that Sam Rockwell has done in his life, you know. But anyway, they get him out of the prison, they get him to the house, and he heals her. But this time he's unable to release the flies. It's taken too much out of him, you know, and he's just in bits. So they have to get him back to the prison. They're really holding him up, and he's fucking gigantic.
Yeah, monstrous man.
So he gets back. Yeah, monstrous. So they get back in the prison. They let Percy out, and Percy's still being a fucking, still the dickhead, even after they've let him out. So fucking, what's his face? John Coffey grabs him, pulls him towards him, and all the flies, all that badness and evil that comes out of the horrible thing that he taken out of Patricia Clarkson, this tumor, he spits it straight into Percy's mouth. He absorbs it all, and Percy just walks down the hall, turns in, looks at Sam Rockwell, and Sam Rockwell's like, what the fuck are you looking at? And he just fucking pulls out a gun and just fucking shoots and empties the gun into him and kills Sam Rockwell.
That sequence is just brilliant.
Both of those dickheads had it coming. It was a fucking get in moment. Yeah, you know, despite the fact that one of them is dead. It's like fucking good enough.
But
like you said, Percy doesn't. He doesn't get to go off and do what he did, kill Delacroix the way he did, torture prisoners, be a sadist, and still get to go off and have a nice, normal fucking life.
Yeah.
So what he does to him, like, he's left catatonic after this and ends up in a mental hospital. He just can't talk. He's just gone. It's such a powerful scene. The next part then is John Coffey shows Tom Hanks exactly what he saw when Sam Rockwell grabbed him. And so he kind of passes some of his gift over to him. He grabs onto him and he shows that it was those two little girls we see from the start.
Yeah.
We see them, that they were living in a house, and Sam Rockwell was a farmhand. And he played the two girls off each other. You tell her, or you scream and I'll kill your sister.
It's fucking creepy.
He was working there as a farmhand. He raped and murdered these two kids. And obviously John Coffey came across them, tried to take it back, tried to bring them back to life, but it was too late. They'd already gone. So when they found him, he was just crying, stroking the hair of these two blonde girls. And they just assumed, as rightly they would, he's a murderer, you know? I can't believe I've condensed this movie, because I'm nearly towards the end. I can't believe I've condensed it in such a small amount of time.
It's fantastic.
But yeah, the last few scenes are just heartbreaking. Like I can actually, as I'm saying this and talking about it now, feel myself welling up.
Yeah, me too.
Just, you know, it's brilliant. It's so well done. Like talking to him in the cell, and as they walk out of the cell, and he's telling them that this is the thing that has to do, and he's tired of seeing all the horrible things that we all do to each other, all the horrible things in the world that people just can't be together and be nice to each other, that it's just killing and murdering, and it's just, you know, it's just horrific. And he talks about how he had a wonderful dream, and in the dream he was there and the two girls were alive and happy, and Mr. Jingles was there, and then he just asked him, is there anything else we can do for you before you go? And he's like, well, I've never seen a movie before. And so they bring him in, and I think I'm not sure, is it Clark Gable? I don't know the movie. Is it Clark Gable or something dancing or singing?
Yeah.
And they get to just see him in there, and like, he's just amazed by this, you know, moving picture show. And then they take him off, you know, to bring him to be killed. And Jesus Christ, that Barry Crepper crying is what started me crying.
Oh yeah, yeah.
They're just broken.
Excellent crying, like, because you can see in the scene before he bursts out the tears, Tom Hanks is telling him, like, you know, when he's looking at
his
white,
yeah,
keep your eyes dry, wipe your face before you stand up again. But his crying is amazing.
Just almost as good as that is David Morris holding back the tears. Like, you're looking at him, and that is the face of a man who is just fucking dying to cry, because they know the injustice. They've seen the miracles that this thing, and like Tom Hanks is so terrified, because he's like, what is God going to do to me when I finally meet my maker? I've taken one of God's, I'm in charge. I'm the one flicking the switch and taking one of God's greatest gifts out of this planet. You know, what will happen to me? Like, can I just say I was doing my job? You know, it's just, but they're all in bits. I was in bits. And he asked, and the last thing he asked for is, like, they ask, they're about to electrocute him and they have to put the mask on over his face, you know? And it got me angry just before then, because William Sadler was the father of the two girls that are dying, and him and his wife are screaming, like, God, fucking fry him twice. He needs to be killed.
Yeah, yeah.
At this point, you know, I started off assuming he'd kill him. At this point, I'm going, shut the fuck up, Dick, can't even do anything.
Yeah, leave
him alone. He's a miracle. But he just says, can you not put the mask on me? You know, I get afraid of the dark.
Afraid of the dark, yeah.
And so I was like, and you're like, oh God, I'm going to have to see him getting fucking electrocuted. And so that's what they do. They flick the switch, and all the fucking, he gets electrocuted and he dies. And it's just the absolute injustice of it. You know, it's just absolutely heartbreaking.
But it's the moment.
It's such a powerful scene.
Like, when he asked for the hood not to be put on, you know, and afraid of the dark, that's the start of, from that moment onwards, for the next, like, 2 minutes, is just, Yeah, even just thinking about it now, yeah, as you were saying, you get kind of almost emotional. But like when he says, "I'm afraid of the dark," and then Tom Hanks walks over and just kind of shakes his hand, and you're like, "Oh, fuck me, man! It's so beautiful." It's these movies, moments in movies like that make good movies great movies. You know, when you realize how much the film has grabbed you at that moment, how much has taken hold of your heart, really, like. And good, Thomas Newman's score just swells, and we get that beautiful shot.
It's so good.
The score is amazing, and Thomas Newman, like to be able to do a score like this, not coming off the back of, but like he did Shawshank as well, and to have, you know, to give it new life and a fresh feel for another, let's say, you know, prison drama. But that shot with Tom Hanks as the music swells and the lights kind of shatter behind him, and it's just like, fucking hell, it's just absolutely glorious, and then the tears flow, you know. Their tears and ours, and like, yeah, I bawled my eyes out. And
yeah,
I think, yeah, it's the reason you sit in theater as well. Remember, it's just being in there, and just everyone was bawling. It's not just like, oh, the girls are crying. Look around, everyone's just in bits, like absolute bits.
Yeah. And it still hits, like as I said, you know, it's over the 25 years since this has been out, I've seen it tons of times. So many people have seen it tons of times, I'm sure. As I said, it's been on terrestrial TV here so many times. It makes the majority of lists, movie places that do lists of top 100s, it's going to be in there, you know. It's but it's still hit, you know, watching it back again. That scene is just, as I said, like I can feel the lump of my throat talking about it, because it's so powerful.
And it's like Tom Hanks always gets, like at this point in his career, you know, his Tom Hanks's everyday man was such as like a staple of his films, and like the acting talent that you kind of take for granted, you know, to such a degree that you almost don't see it. You don't even notice that he's brilliant. Yet you can't imagine the movie without him in it. And even that scene alone, it's so understated. Everyone's trying not to show emotion. It's like underplayed, but it's overpowering by how much it's underplayed. And Tom Hanks is that in a nutshell. Like, there's no grand scene stealing attempt. He just stands there, and just he's the leader of the pack, and just holds his own, and just watch this man die. And it's just, I just think, Tom Hanks is just, he's so fucking good in these type of movies when it's not a Castaway or a something where it's a overtly dramatic role. But he's so good in this where it's just, you can't imagine him not in it, but nothing stands out as being, you know, scene stealing kind of stuff from him, which I think is just is wonderful. Like,
I think it makes him more believable. You know, you really buy him as this character, and this, you know, just there. Like, I there was a part of me, I remember going back when I first saw it, there was a part of me thought he wasn't going to do it, because, you know, he's like, you have to say roll on too, and he's standing there, and he just doesn't want to say it. He's just staring at Michael Clarke Duncan. And David Morse is like, you have to say it. You have to say it. You have to call it. It's just like, and part of me, when the first time watching, it's like, he's not going to say it. Something's going to happen. You know, another miracle is going to happen. There's no way they're going to kill this bloke. But kill him they do. And it's, what happens then is we get a time jump then, and we're back into modern day with the older Tom Hanks. And he's explaining to his friend that he's actually really 108 years old, that he had a grown son. He's like, I know you were, when I was talking about my grown son, he's like, the math doesn't add up, does it? He's like, no. And he's like, well, asked him when he grabbed me and showed me what Sam Rockwell had done, is he passed some of his gift to me. And it's a gift, but it's a curse. He's like, I'm 108 years old. I've watched my kids die. I've watched my wife die. I'm going to watch you die. I've watched everybody die. And someday, eventually I'll die. But for now, he goes, this is my punishment. You know, it's his punishment for killing a miracle of God. Like, he brings her up this little shack that he has, and Mr. Jingles, the mouse, is still alive. And he's like, this is my punishment for, you know, basically for killing a miracle of God, is to live this life and to see all the people I care about die before me. And he's amazing as well. Like, I think he's a dab, the surname of the actor, I can't remember his name. But he's great as well. Like, him getting upset at the start because the movie comes on the TV and you don't know why he's crying at this movie, but it's because it's the same movie that John Coffey sees when he has to go and see a movie, you know?
Yeah,
obviously it brought it back, and that's why he gets so upset. But yeah, that's it. Like, it's I've milled through that movie in, you know, whatever, half an hour.
Pretty good going.
It's just, like I said, it's so, despite the fact that I've gone through it in half an hour, it is well worth its 3 hours. It doesn't overstay its welcome. I've just cut out a lot of little parts, and there's so many funny parts. I've cut out a lot of that and just kind of kept with the grim stuff, you know. But there's a lot of funny stuff, a lot of building up and showing you about Mr. Jingles, the mouse, and how he is with Delacroix, getting more time with him, with the Native American who's the first guy who's killed. And there's a lot of scenes really showing the humanity of Tom Hanks on that block compared to the likes of Percy. Like, he's, as far as he's concerned, they've been sentenced. This is their time. They're going to die because of it. You don't need to antagonize them. We're here to make sure they see out their sentence. That doesn't mean you have to be a sadist. It doesn't mean you have to treat them like animals. And so that's how he does it. He has a distraction where he gets them off the block so he can do test runs of what their execution is going to be like. Okay, you come in here, you do this. And he does it while he distracts them, so they don't need to be there. They don't need to have that hanging over them any more than it already is. And it's a wonderful way of showing, look, this is my job. It's my care. I'm filling out my duty, but I don't hate you. You know, I don't hate you for the crime that you've committed. I see you as another human being, but a human being who your peers have decided, the law has decided that you need to die for what you've done. And they're all like that. You know, they all, the other guards, bar Percy, are like that. You know what I mean? I don't know if that would have been an accurate reflection of what these prison guards are or were. I don't want to disparage any prison guards from the 1930s in America.
Yeah, but hard to know, really, but... Yeah. But they it's do play it off. It's very poetic and tragic in the same breath, you know?
Yeah.
And I know there's people talk about the religious, you say, undertones, but it's you know, John Coffey, JC, Jesus Christ, all these kind of things. You could deep dive down some threads online regarding that. But I don't ever have a religious bone in my body, but I can tap into that kind of spiritual essence that they play out here. It's that kind of beautiful poignance. Yeah, it's quite nice. And I just love a sad ending. Like, you just fucking...
Yeah.
Yeah, there's nothing better than walking out of the cinema.
Just like, right, I'm going to head to bed. go to bed.
Did you call my mum?
Yeah, it was... it's so well done. I think maybe it hits home a little bit more watching it now because Michael Clarke Duncan has passed.
You know, yeah.
Sadly, and... You know, watching him and what an incredible performance. I think he was nominated for the Oscar for it, which is great, and which he didn't win, unfortunately. But it was funny. One of the bits of trivia that I picked up was that one of the people considered for the role of John Coffey, Shaquille O'Neal. Isn't that unreal? Just because he's a gigantically tall black man. Like, oh yeah, let's consider him.
Can
for
we
the
get
role.
His lines of dialogue down to half a line, please?
That the movie would have been an hour and a half long, so this we can't be listening to. I love Shaq.
He's a mute.
Shaq. Michael Clarke. Yeah.
I'd always find it fascinating. Okay. Yeah, you could do a whole piece on movies, what could have been, you know, with kind of even first choice actors, just like, oh god. Mm. Like Will Smith as Morpheus in The Matrix and all these kind of things. Just like, what?
Will Smith was Neo, wasn't it?
I think Will Smith was Neo. Was he supposed to be Neo? Oh, fucking hell.
Yeah, yeah.
That's like,
I think Morpheus is supposed to be white. Like, I think it was the other way around. I think Morpheus was like fucking Mickey Rourke or something shit like that. But yeah, Will Smith was chosen.
B-movie schlock. Wow. Yeah. Badly. Shaquille O'Neal. Wow. That's something else.
But look, that was a fun one to go through, Daz. I did burn through it because, as I said, it's a huge long movie. And I think if I started going into some of the funny bits, I'll start going into all of them. And we hear all it's a wonderful movie just to revisit. And to recap for people, maybe people who haven't watched it in a while might want to watch it. Or if you haven't seen it, the fact that I have left out shitloads of parts on it means that maybe you might get a fucking massive enjoyment for it. But yeah, it's a great movie. I've liked most of Frank Darabont's stuff. And the only one I didn't like was one we disagreed on, I think, was The Mist. I wasn't a fan of everything bar the ending. Loved the ending.
Yeah, well,
but I wasn't a fan of it.
It hasn't really done that much since. You know, it was Shawshank, it was this, The Mist. He's done a lot of kind of TV stuff, and then did Walking Dead. Walking Dead just took over his life, pretty much, for the last 10 years. But I mean, it's mad for Darabont, for a directorial debut, to be Shawshank Redemption, one of most revered. And it's around the top, or if not at the top of many people's greatest movies of all time list. So to kind of to follow up with your sophomore effort and to choose another prison drama, a long prison drama, was kind of, yeah, it was a brave choice. But yeah.
Actually, that's another one. Tom Hanks was picked up, was the choice to play Andy Dufresne.
No way.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. So this was kind of the one that he, this is kind of the one that he owed him. You know, yeah, for not doing
came
that.
Down again.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's mad. But yeah, that was, well, yeah, that was brilliant, man.
It was good fun. It was
really nice, really nice retelling of that movie. So definitely give it a watch. So on to our retro corner now, and it is Worms Armageddon. Released in 1999, late 99, Worms Armageddon was actually the third entry in the popular franchise. The original was in 1995. I think it was an instant hit. Initially planned as an expansion to Worms 2, Armageddon evolved into its own standalone game. Now, I played this on the Nintendo 64. What I think it was out on the PlayStation, the Dreamcast, PC, and the Game Boy Color. It's mad when you see Game Boy Color listed in what games were, yeah, fucking showing our age. but yeah, while the N64 at the time was lacking in third-party support, a little bit, well, say a little bit majorly, there's no doubt that the N64 was an absolute fucking monster for multiplayer games, with an incredible, incredibly impressive library, like Super Smash Brothers, GoldenEye, Mario Kart, you know, and this added to that collection. Now, for those who have not played Worms, all four of you, it's a you take control of a small platoon of worms and you battle other worm platoons on 2D levels. And one of the best things about these levels were they were procedurally generated. So every time you start a level, and the map is completely different, or to a certain extent. The battles are turn-based. It's probably the only turn-based combat I actually like. But the matches, your worms are kitted out with a fantastic assortment of weaponry, from bazookas to grenades, dynamite, homing missiles, homing pigeons, banana bombs, super banana bombs, and holy hand grenades, which are one of the best weapons known to man. Just like the... before it goes off, you just say, hallelujah. Oh my God. But yeah, like many, many more crazy, crazy, wonderful weapons. The game had a decent single player campaign, but multiplayer is where this became an absolute classic for the ages. You could name, like, if you're a platoon, I think, I can't remember if it was 4 or 6 in Worms Armageddon. But do you remember, was it a platoon of 4?
Oh, I don't remember. I don't remember how many worms. No, it's got to be 6. 4 seems way too
I think
small.
It was... Yeah, because in single player, I think you can change it, but I can't remember what it was in the multiplayer. But yeah, you can name them. So I remember when we'd be playing, you'd spend your time naming them. And it just became more personal then, because you'd be giving it names of your favorite movie characters or whatever, or your family. But yeah, the gameplay was just... astonishing, like absolutely astonishing. Like, you throw in some last minute jetpack dashes across the screen to move away from a grenade you just dropped, and you have some of the most hilarious, genius, and downright fantastic multiplayer experiences I think I've ever had. And this was back in the days of, I know online gaming was a thing with this game on PC, but on consoles we were still many, many years away from proper online gaming. So this was old school. Get all your mates into the room, into your sitting room, sitting on the couch, bag of cans, get high as fuck, sit down and just play this for hours upon hours upon hours. I've had some of the greatest multiplayer moments ever playing this game, and Phil was there for many of them. You remember this bad boy, yeah?
Yeah, man, this is just such a fun time. I mean, the name of them are great. You know, you're just naming them after the Spice Girls or something like that. Oh, fuck it, you just killed Posh, you piece of
bastard.
Shit. Like, that was it. You're playing against each other, and the thing with the weapons was that they weren't unlimited. You know, you didn't have unlimited this, that, the other. So you kind of had to go, okay, what way will I use it? You know, certain weapons are best to, say, shoot underneath them with, like, a rocket launcher that will make them fly off the edge. there was very few of them that were like one shot kills, because it hit the tiny little energy bar over their head. So if you didn't kill them, and the thing is that you could only move and then use a weapon. So you couldn't like go and run off as far as you go. You had one the other. So you could go right up to somebody, and then if you make a balls of it, like you don't shoot them, but you go to uppercut them and you miss, and that's your fucking turnover. The next guy, when it starts his turn, you're this fucking far away from him on the screen. It's like, oh, you are fucking screwed. And it was so much fun because it was a funny game too, as in the lines that it would spit out. Like, even if your guy got blown up, it would give you a funny line. Or if your guy went into the water, it'd come up like, oh, fucking Phil, Phil's after drowning, water way to go, and stuff like that. And just real, Daz is pushing up daisies into the little grave where your worm used to be. Yeah. And they're just these tiny little characters that pull out bazookas, and they have little squeaky voices, chipmunk style voices. And it's just, the premise is so simple. But like you said, it really lends itself to couch co-op because of the fact 100%. That it's switching over to your turn. And what it really lent itself to was a bunch of us getting high, because you could sit there and you're smoking a spliff and it's not your turn. And it's like, right, take that over there. It's my go. And you just fucking play for God. And that was what it was. People could just pass the control around and just, it was so relaxed. It was not the intensity of fucking Mario Kart where you're just fucking waiting for those fucking few minutes to be over where you're just. It was such a chilled multiplayer experience. And it was great. Like, I love some of the predecessors as well. Worms 3D. I remember playing that with a buddy of ours, McCoy. Listen to some tunes, listen to Groove Ramad, listen to great tunes, and just playing Worms, man. It was just...
Yeah, and the franchise is still growing. Great game. To this day, it's I think they've churned out like 20 follow-ups, or there's 20 plus entries. And as of 2020... to turn 17, I think the developer was still updating this one, Worms Armageddon, updating with patches, and additional content and stuff, which is just really nice to see, because obviously they couldn't have envisaged how monstrous and world conquering this game would become. Some fucking great memories, like so strategic as well. Because it would always come down to, if there was four platoons, let's say four or six worms each, it would come down to just like maybe three left or two left. And it's just, you've exhausted all your fucking weapons and all you have is just your bazooka. And that's the only thing that you wouldn't run out of. Or maybe you had a bazooka and someone else had one grenade left. And because it was wind involved as well. And you've got this one throw and you're just trying to fucking throw it into the wind so we'll catch and go down a little hole and get this guy. And some really strategic panic and delirium in equal measure. I fucking loved it. So I played it again last week on Steam, where I think I picked it up for €3. So there's no excuse to pick up this and have a fucking game. Like, even the single player, it's a bit of fun, but if you can get some buddies online, 100% is not to be missed. So is our retro corner for this week, and we'll wrap up this episode of Middle-Aged Geeks. This is the first of four of our Party Like It's 1999. Next week I will be tackling it is Fight Club. And do you know what you're going to do for your retro yet?
I'll keep it as a surprise, because I haven't told you yet, so I'll keep it as a surprise.
Even better.
Yeah.
But so please tune in for that. So just a message to everyone listening, to thank you for all the support, and keep listening, playing, and following us on social media, and get some feedback to us on middleagedgeeks@yahoo.com. We'll have some, didn't have time for some feedback today, but have some nice feedback on some of the previous episodes for next week. So anything else from yourself there, Phil?
No, just echo everything you've said, Daz. Just keep on following, sharing, liking, subscribing, all that good stuff. And I look forward to speaking about Fight Club next week. Like, it's a joy to be rewatching these movies that we're going to be doing this.
So easy.
I really hope that the rest of you kind of join us and watch along. Watch Fight Club between now and next week and join in the banter with us. So
happy days. So from Phil and myself, that's a wrap. See you next week. Ciao.
Take it easy, guys.